Thank you, Vajratara, for those kind words of introduction. I'm very happy to be back in Sheffield. My last visit was about 6 years ago, I think it was, on the occasion of the opening of this then new centre of the FWBO. And I have quite vivid memories of that occasion. But 6 years is quite a long time, and during that time quite a lot has happened. I've visited quite a few centres of the FWBO in the course of the last few years, and now here I am again, here in Coventry. Sorry, here in Freudian slip, Sheffield. And I've been having quite a happy time. I've seen all the improvements that have been made in the course of the last 6 years. In fact, one might say the place has been really transformed. It doesn't feel like a church at all now. And I've been strolling around the garden, admiring the tangled vegetation and the roses and the allotment. And I've also been having meals, lunches and dinners with different groups of people, which has been very enjoyable. And in fact, just this evening I was having dinner with the Sheffield Evolution Shop team, and they were telling me, I think they were telling me rather proudly, that they were one of the five remaining shop teams, evolution shop teams in the FWBO, which were manned entirely by members of the Sangha. And I was very pleased to hear that, because team-based right livelihood has always been very close to my heart, and I'm glad to know that it's flourishing here in Sheffield along with the other FWBO activities. In the course of the conversation over dinner, somehow the subject of South London came up. And I, of course, am from South London. And I was brought up in Tooting. A lot of people laugh when they hear the word Tooting. I don't know quite why. But that is where I was brought up. I wasn't actually born in Tooting. I was born in Stockwell, which is even worse. But when I look back, I think in a way how extraordinary it was, how extraordinary it is, that someone whose whole life has been devoted to the Dharma and who ended up founding a new Buddhist order should have seen the light of day in South London, of all places, and been brought up in Tooting, in a very ordinary, you know, working class family. My father was just a French polisher, sometimes out of work. My mother was just an ordinary housewife. So it seems very strange that someone like me should have emerged from those sort of surroundings. But it's as though from the very beginning there was a very definite direction of my life, a very definite direction of the whole course of my being. I remember I first learned about the Buddha, Siddhartha Gautama, when I was about 8 or 9 and confined to bed. I learned about him from the pages of an encyclopedia. I also learned about other founders of religion. I learned about Muhammad and I learned about Zarathustra, as well as about the Buddha. But Muhammad didn't appeal to me particularly. I don't think even Zarathustra did. But the Buddha certainly appealed to me. And pictures of the Buddha, or rather of images of the Buddha, which I saw in that encyclopedia, stuck in my mind. And a few years later, when I happened to be in Brighton with my family on holiday, I happened to see in the window of a bric-a-brac shop a small brass image of the Buddha. I think it must have been a very tiny replica of the famous Kamakura Buddha of Japan. So I went into the shop and bought it with my pocket money. I must have been, 12 or 13 at the time. And not only did I buy that little image, I bought at the same time a few sticks of incense. What I later came to know was Indian incense, very black and very sweet. And when we got home, I remember, I used to put this little image on the table, and I used to burn one of my precious incense sticks. And I just did this without really understanding the significance of what I was doing. My parents must have seen me doing this. They didn't make any comment. They were used to me having strange interests and strange ideas. So nothing was said. Of course, during the next few years, I read very widely in literature and philosophy. And as a result of that reading, I came to realize that I wasn't a Christian. Though I had attended a Christian church for a while, it hadn't made much impression on me. So I think it was when I was about 14 or 15 at the latest that I realized that I definitely am not a Christian. That was quite clear in my mind. But what was I? I didn't know, not yet. But a time did come when, in the course of my reading, I came across books on Buddhism, and more important still, I came across actual Buddhist texts, or rather, translations of Buddhist texts. And in particular, I came across translations of the Diamond Sutra and the Sutra of Wai Lang, the Platform Sutra, as it's usually called. And when I read these, especially the Diamond Sutra, I at once felt that, well, this is what I really believe. This is what I've believed all the time. I've always believed what this sutra teaches. That was my actual experience, my actual realization at that time. But I had not as yet met any other Buddhist. I was all on my own. And I don't think I talked about my reading or my interest in Buddhism with anybody whom I knew. But eventually, I came to hear of the London Buddhist Society, and I started corresponding with the editor of their magazine, and I started going along to their classes. This must have been in 1941-42. Mm. And I made friends there. And it was there that I started to meditate after a fashion. I can't remember what sort of meditation we did, though I did remember that, I do remember that the Buddhist Society had published a book called Concentration and Meditation, which I must have read. And I also remember that Mr. Humphreys, the founder of the Buddhist Society, used to recommend that we started off with learning to concentrate on a matchbox. Which of course some of us duly did. Yeah? But of course, by this time, we were in the midst of war. Hmm? We were in the midst of war. And I was, of course, living in London still. And I caught part of the Blitz. And I remember that on one occasion I was at the Buddhist Society's premises, which were situated above a tea shop in Great Russell Street. We were just sitting on our chairs, not on our cushions of course, no one sat on cushions in those days, everyone sat on chairs, and we were meditating. At least our eyes were closed and we were inwardly concentrating, perhaps on a matchbox, perhaps on something else. Huh? But anyway, we were quiet. Hmm? But suddenly there was the noise of a tremendous explosion. Hmm? A bomb had fallen quite near, and the windows all rattled. But we didn't move. Hmm? So we weren't doing so badly for beginners, you might say. We didn't move. Hmm? But then along came the army. I was conscripted and I was sent to India. I wasn't at all pleased or happy to be in the army. I hadn't expected that they'd take me in view of my medical history. But perhaps they were getting a bit desperate, so they took me. And I didn't like the army at all. And I ignored it as much as I could and pursued my own interests as best I could. I certainly continued to read books on Buddhism whenever I had the opportunity. But I was very glad to be sent to India because India was the land of the Buddha. Many of my friends and colleagues in the unit, they were dismayed when we heard that we were going to be sent to India. India was like, well, going to the ends of the earth. So far away from their families, they weren't at all happy. But I was very pleased. No, not that I was pleased to be separated from my family by so wide a distance, but I was pleased, I was thrilled with the idea of actually being in India, the land of the Buddha. But of course, in those days, there were very few Buddhists in India, very few indeed, hardly any. It was difficult to meet a Buddhist for some years. So I carried on with my study of Buddhism through books. For about a year, I was in Singapore, still in the army. And in Singapore, I made friends with a number of Chinese Buddhists. I got to know something about Chinese Buddhism at first hand. But then, after 4 years in the army, I left. And as some of you know, those who've read my memoirs know, I took up a sort of wandering life in India. Not as a tourist. I did it properly, so to speak. I became a wandering freelance ascetic. Shaved my head, shaved off my beard, which had grown by that time, and donned the yellow robes, the saffron robes of the wandering monk. So, with a companion, a Bengali companion, I spent a couple of years wandering around India, sometimes staying in ashrams, sometimes staying in caves, and devoting myself to meditation and the study of the Dharma. Of course, I came into contact with many, many Hindus. Of course, Hindus were all over the place. Most of the people I came into contact with were Hindus. And I came into contact with some famous teachers, so I even spent time with them. But though I came into quite close contact with some of these teachers, my faith in the Dharma never wavered. I was always quite clear that it was through the Dharma that I wanted to devote my life. And a sort of turning point came, again, as some of you may know, when I was staying in a cave on the Arunachala mountain. And one night I had a vision, which I've described in my memoirs. I had a vision of the Red Buddha, Amitabha. And it was a rather unusual vision, as I thought at the time at least, because this Red Buddha was seated on a red lotus, and the lotus was floating on the waters of the ocean. And this Buddha, in his right hand, he was holding up a red lotus, and behind him, to one side, the sun was setting, and the light of the sun, the setting sun, was glittering on the waves. So this was a very vivid experience, and I took it to mean that it was time that I should take monastic ordination in the formal sense. As I mentioned, at the time I thought that the kind of Buddha figure I had seen in this vision was not very traditional. I'd never seen a picture of a red Buddha holding up a red lotus. Huh? So for many years, in fact, I thought that this was something not quite traditional. But not so many years ago, someone sent me a picture postcard from Nepal, a postcard of a tanka, and there was the red Buddha with a red lotus in his hand, holding it up exactly as I had seen it in my vision. So I realized that my vision wasn't so untraditional as I had thought. And not only that, somebody else, one of our friends, told me that when they visited Kalimpong and went to see the temple built by Dzogchen Rinpoche, they saw amongst the murals, the paintings on the walls, again, a figure of this same red Buddha holding up the red lotus flower. So again, it's as though that old vision of mine wasn't so untraditional as I had originally thought. So, as I said, I took this vision to mean that it was time I got myself properly ordained, joined the monastic sangha. So I was ordained as a samanera at Kusinara, and subsequently as a bhikshu at Saranath. So I was very truly on track, so to speak. And then, of course, I spent some time with Bhikshu Kashyap studying Pali. He took me up to Kalimpong and left me there, exhorting me to stay there and work for the good of Buddhism, which I proceeded to do by starting, among other things, the Young Men's Buddhist Association, which could be regarded as a sort of trial run for the FWBO. And, well, in the course of the years that followed, I continued to study, continued to meditate, continued to practice the Dharma, and was so fortunate as to receive instruction and initiation from some very distinguished Tibetan lamas as well as from a Chinese hermit yogi. So 14 years, productive years, passed in Kalimpong. I did quite a lot of writing, including the survey of Buddhism. And I also got involved with the movement of mass conversion in the plains of India, which had been started by Dr. Ambedkar. So in that way, my mind, my life, you know, followed a very definite course. And of course, in 1964, I came back to this country after an absence of 20 years, and 2-3 years later, I started the FWBO and WBO. And the rest, of course, is, as they say, history, and of course, a history of which all of you are now part. So, as I look back now, as an old man, nearly 83, I can't help thinking that there must have been some reason why I followed that particular path. There must have been some reason why my life followed that particular course, without any real deviation. I mean, even the army couldn't stop me studying Buddhism. And I wasn't tempted by all these famous Hindu teachers. I stuck to the Dharma. The Dharma was my path. It was the Dharma that I wanted to immerse myself in. It was the Dharma that I wanted to experience. It was the Dharma that I wanted to communicate. This was always clear to me. So sometimes I wonder, well, where did this tremendous urge come from? This urge which has played the dominant part in my life, you know, for the last at least 60 years, well over 60 years in fact. And when I look back and think, well, what sort of surroundings was I born into? Very ordinary, you know, working class, you know, surroundings in Tooting of all places. So what was there, you know, to account for my interest? And I can only assume that in all likelihood it was some very powerful sanskara carried over from a previous existence which had impelled me to continue to follow a path which I had followed before, and to reconnect with teachings and practices and experiences with which I had been connected in previous lives. So this has always been to me one of the considerations which has led me to accept the idea of rebirth. Now, I deliberately use the word consideration because it isn't a proof. And many people might say that I'm quite mistaken and that my interest in Buddhism, my devotion to the Dharma, could be explained by some sort of gene in my makeup. But to me, it doesn't seem like that at all. To me, it really does seem as though I was following a path in this life which I had trodden in previous lives. So it is one of the considerations on account of which I do believe in the effect of rebirth. Of course, there are some other considerations too. This is not the only one. And as I said, again, I emphasize that I don't regard my impression or even conviction that I must have followed this path before as in any way constituting a proof, much less a scientific proof, which might convince those who did not believe in the fact or idea of rebirth. But yes, there were no doubt other considerations. I'm going to talk now a bit about dreams. I wasn't really expecting to talk much about dreams, but I think I will. And people are often interested in dreams anyway. And we know, according to some Buddhist texts, that Siddhartha had quite a number of significant dreams before he was enlightened. In fact, I wrote a poem on one of those dreams, which some of you may have come across. Dreams obviously make up quite an important part of our lives. In India, there's a traditional division of the human psyche into four parts, so to speak. There's the waking state. There's the state of deep dreamless sleep. There's the dream state. And there's what they call the turiya, the fourth, which covers all the higher, you know, meditative experiences. So dreams do make up part of our experience, part of our personality almost. And many dreams, of course, perhaps the majority, are just reflections, shadows, of things that have happened to us in the course of the day. But I personally believe that there are dreams of a quite different kind also. And I've had many experiences of these dreams of another kind, and perhaps some of you have too. I call these dreams archetypal dreams. Dreams which are not just echoes of the day's events, but which have a higher or deeper, you know, significance. And I've had these sort of archetypal dreams from time to time in the course of my life. I remember in particular one such archetypal dream which repeated itself in various forms again and again in the course of a number of years. I remember the first time I dreamt this dream, it took this particular form. There was a mountain in the dream, and it was in South India. I had this dream, by the way, in India itself, before I came back to Britain. At the foot of this mountain, there was an ashram. And this ashram was open to the public. And there were people coming and going. But behind the ashram, there was a stair cut out of the rock, a sort of secret stair. And this led up to another ashram, much higher up and much smaller, which people usually didn't know anything about. And it opened onto, the stairs opened onto a wide platform. In the dream, I climbed up these stairs and found myself on that platform, looking out over the landscape. And it was a very broad landscape, and there were several factories dotted here and there. But not only that, at the top of the stairs there was a man, an elderly man in a white robe, and behind him there was a sort of showcase like you see in Tibetan temples, with lots of Buddha images behind the glass. So this was the image, this was the dream, the archetypal dream. The ashram at the foot of the mountain, the public ashram, and the secret ashram, which very few people knew about, at the top of the stairs behind that public ashram. So this sort of dream appeared to me many, many times in different forms, but there were always two buildings, one of which was public, as it were, and well known. The other was distant or hidden or unknown, or sometimes even in ruins. And in some dreams, people had forgotten about its existence. So I used to reflect on this dream quite a lot and ask myself, well, what it meant. I won't tell you the result of my reflections. They varied from time to time. But perhaps you'd like to reflect on that dream yourself, or even ask yourselves if you've had anything like it in the course of your own experience. So that's what I mean by a sort of archetypal dream, which has a deep significance, perhaps. And I want to fast forward now to maybe 5 or 6 years ago. And some of you know that 5 or 6 years ago, I had a whole year of chronic insomnia, for which I could never discover the cause. It was quite extreme, quite severe, amounting in fact to what's known as sleep deprivation. And it was therefore a very painful period, a very painful experience. Since I wasn't able to sleep, I was able to sleep very little. My energy drained away. And I sometimes thought that, well, I might even die. I seemed to have so little energy. I was so utterly exhausted. And friends were very concerned. And I was quite well looked after during that period. And also was very much helped by acupuncture. But anyway, it was a quite painful period. And all I could do was just to remain aware, practice patience, and try not to feel frustrated. But there were compensations. In fact, I may say, there was a silver lining to that very dark cloud. In fact, I might even say there was a golden lining. Because during that whole period, I had some wonderful archetypal dreams. I didn't sleep very much. I slept very little. But when I did sleep, I had wonderful archetypal dreams of very great significance. And it felt like a real gift, a real reward, a very positive experience, even I might say often a genuinely spiritual experience. And these archetypal dreams took many forms. One form was that of all sorts of beautiful, brilliant jewels. I've always been fond of precious stones or semi-precious stones for the sake of their beautiful iridescent colours. But in my dreams I saw the most wonderful precious stones and semi-precious stones of all colours, all very glittering and magnificent and beautiful, and arranged in wonderful patterns and shapes. And these were immensely inspiring. And again, I used to have these archetypal dreams of wonderful scenery, very often mountain scenery, such as perhaps what doesn't exist on Earth, and very often at the edge of the sea. And sometimes I'd be high up in the air, you know, looking down on the sea, looking down on these mountains. And sometimes I'd be in subterranean caverns which contained all sorts of treasures. So I had many, many such dreams, all of which I found very inspiring and which helped to sustain me during that year of chronic insomnia, of sleep deprivation. You may wonder why I'm going on about these dreams, but I will come to something that you may find perhaps more interesting. I also used to have dreams of my various teachers. I didn't have these dreams very often, but they did come from time to time. and they still come, and sometimes they're very vivid indeed. And there was one occasion when I had dreams of all my teachers, and that was during the week before I handed on my responsibilities as head of the order to a small group of senior order members. Every night during the week immediately preceding that handing on, I dreamt of my teachers. Each night I dreamt of several of them, and in the course of the week I must have dreamt of each and every one of them a number of times. And these dreams were very, very powerful and of a sort of visionary quality. And I took them to mean that in handing on my responsibility of the order, well, for the order in that way, I was doing the right thing, and that in fact what I was doing had the blessing of all my teachers. So it was of great importance to me, and perhaps of importance to the movement as well, especially to the order. But let me now connect up with this question of rebirth. I've also had dreams, though relatively recently, which to me seem like recollections of experiences in another life. Now, of course, I can't prove that they are such, but some of these dreams have been of such intensity, not the same archetypal intensity that I've spoken about in connection with some of these archetypal dreams, but a quite different kind of intensity, as though they were actual recollections of things that had happened to me in previous lives. I'll give you just one example. It, as far as I can make out, thinking it over afterwards, I was living in the 8th or 9th century in this country at a time when what we now call England was divided into 7 or 8 independent kingdoms which were sometimes at war. And I was the prior of a little priory. The prior of a little priory, believe it or not. And I had under me 24 monks. 24. And one day, and this is the incident that I dreamt about, or which I remembered, a representative of the king of the particular kingdom where I was living came and said, well, the king is at war with a neighbouring king. He needs soldiers. You've got to send 12 of your monks to fight the soldiers, you know, for the king. So, sadly and reluctantly, I had to part with 12 of my monks and send them off to be soldiers and fight for the king. And a little later on, I don't know exactly how much later on, the dream continued, and I was in the presence of the king, with other counselors, advisors. The king was seated on his throne, we were all standing, and we were addressing him in turn, and it came to me to address him in my turn. And I can't, just after waking up, I could remember what I had said to the king, but it didn't last, and I can't now remember. But I spoke, I said something to the king, with regard to the political situation. So these particular dreams were of such a kind, different from ordinary dreams, different even from archetypal dreams, but that I could only conclude that, well, they probably were reminiscences of another life. So this is one of another of the considerations that leads me to accept the idea or the fact of rebirth. And I think it quite likely that some of the things that people experience in the dream state are in fact recollections of, or effects of, experiences in previous existences. But as I said, I call them all considerations that lead one or lead me to believe in rebirth. They cannot be regarded as proof. But there are other considerations too. I don't know if any of you have heard of an English Buddhist called Francis Story. He died some years ago, and he spent much of his life in Sri Lanka. He was an Anagarika, and he was especially interested in this idea of rebirth. And he wanted to see if it could be empirically verified. And he did a great deal of research, mainly in Burma, where he also spent quite a lot of time. And he investigated a number of cases where young children spoke about their having lived with some other family before, in some other place. And he investigated a number of these cases, and he came to the conclusion that in some of these cases, the only possible explanation was that these children were remembering their existence in a previous life, usually in Burma also, and not very far away from where they had, so to speak, reincarnated in this current life of theirs. So Francis Story investigated these cases in that way and concluded that there was the possibility of an empirical verification of at least some, or the truth of at least some of these alleged recollections of previous existences. So this is another consideration to be added to the ones that I've already mentioned, and perhaps it is a consideration that has a little more weight than the others that I've mentioned, which might appear to be of a rather subjective nature. But we can go a step further. I've known at least two people who claimed to be to have remembered their previous existence. One of these was Lama Govinda, and the other was Dalgo Rinpoche. Dalgo Rinpoche, of course, was a tulku. I don't know whether other tulkus had any recollection of their previous existences. When I was in Kalimpong, I wasn't especially interested in the question of rebirth. Or perhaps I should say, not so much that I wasn't interested, but I wasn't interested in trying to establish it as a fact. I sort of took it for granted, as did the Buddhists all around me. But I do remember discussing it with Dorota Rinpoche, and he told me that he could in fact remember his previous life, but that the recollection faded when he was about 7, and he seemed to think that that was very often what happened, that before the age of seven, one might well be able to recollect previous existences, but after that, well, the present life crowded in upon one and those old memories were overlaid and eventually forgotten. But apparently his mother remembered an incident where when he was very young, he must have been less than 7 or 8, a female devotee had invited him for a meal. And for some reason or other, she had the impression that the young Rinpoche was not very willing to go to her house for the meal. So she expressed that feeling. So the young Rinpoche said, well, why should I be unwilling to go to your house for a meal? I've done it many times before. And his mother took that to mean that, well, he was referring to his previous existence, when he had in fact gone to this woman's house for meals quite a number of times. And Dalada Rinpoche himself confirmed that, yes, this is what he believed had happened, even though at the time that I spoke to him, he didn't have any direct memory of that previous existence, but only remembered that he had remembered, so to speak. And then, of course, there was the case of Lama Govinda. And, of course, you may know that in his book, The Way of the White Clouds, Lama Govinda does discuss the question of rebirth at some length. And he reports, you know, some cases that he came across in Burma. And I remember that one day in the course of conversation, I happened to mention to him that when I read his writings, they reminded me very much of some of the writings of the early German romantics, which I had happened to read, you know, in my teens. And he smiled and he said, yes, that he believed that he had been Novalis, one of these romantic writers, in his previous existence. And he said he had had once the experience, a strange experience, of reading something by Novalis, and it came back to him that, well, he had written this. It was perfectly familiar. And this was one of the reasons why he believed that in a previous existence he had been Novalis. So there are all these sort of considerations, as I call them, that have led me to be reasonably well persuaded that rebirth or reincarnation or metempsychosis, whatever one likes to call it, is in fact, well, a fact, not just a beautiful romantic idea. But of course there's also something else to be borne in mind, and that is of course the testimony of the Buddhist scriptures, where we're quite clearly told that the Buddha did recollect his previous existences and was able to look out and see the births and deaths and rebirths of other beings. But of course, from a modern point of view, people aren't usually convinced if one, so to speak, invokes authority, even the authority of the Buddha. And some people, of course, doubt that the Buddha himself really believed in rebirth. Or sometimes they say that he simply adopted the teaching, you know, because it was current in his time, that everybody believed in rebirth, and therefore so the Buddha did. But the fact is, as is clear from the Buddhist scriptures themselves, especially the Pali scriptures, not everybody in India believed in rebirth. Some of them were nihilists, materialists, and the Buddha sometimes had to convince them. So one can't argue that the Buddha believed in or taught rebirth simply that because it was the common ideology of the time in India. So these, as I've said, are some of the considerations which have led me personally to accept the idea of rebirth. But of course I'm quite aware that for many Western Buddhists and even for some people in the FWBO, belief in rebirth is a bit problematic. And in the course of the last so many years, people have sometimes asked me whether it's possible to be a Buddhist and not believe in rebirth. And of course for many years my standard answer was that yes, you can be a Buddhist and not believe in rebirth, but as a Buddhist of course you accept full enlightenment as the goal of the Buddhist life. So if you don't believe in rebirth, if you don't believe you have another chance later on, you have to go all out to gain enlightenment in this very life. Eh? You have to sacrifice everything, give up everything. That's the only thing that you can do, consistent with your belief in the Buddha as the enlightened one and your lack of belief in rebirth. That suggestion of mine, often didn't go down very well. well, in fact, some people, I think, are genuinely in a dilemma. They believe in the teachings of the Buddha up to a point. They really do want to progress. They want to progress spiritually, but they don't believe in rebirth. Of course, Buddhists in the East do believe in rebirth. And of course, if you believe in rebirth, you also believe that, well, if you don't make it to the higher spiritual levels in this life, well, you can carry on with the journey in a future life. And, well, that's quite true. But the danger is, and this is a real danger in many Buddhist countries, that people put off the real practice of the Dharma to some future life. It's a sort of get-out, that they find it too difficult in this life. All right, they'll do it in another life, under more favorable circumstances. And many of them in some Theravada countries believe, or they pray, to be reborn when Maitreya Buddha is alive, so that then they can hear the Dharma directly from a Buddha and it'll be much, much easier to gain enlightenment. So they don't bother much about actually practicing the Dharma in this life. They just pray to be reborn when Maitreya Buddha is around. So that is a bit of a cop-out, of course. But nonetheless, if as a Western Buddhist you don't believe in rebirth, well, there's a tremendous strain and tension that you've got to do it all now. And no doubt, if you were sufficiently determined, you could do it all now. But I think in the case of those who don't believe in rebirth, the fact that they're brought up against the fact that, well, they have to do it all in this life now or not at all, gives rise to a great deal of tension, even a great deal of anxiety, and is, I think, rather counterproductive. So I think perhaps the best way is to follow a sort of middle way, that we do our best to progress spiritually as much as we can in this life of ours, but we are not too tense, not too much under strain, believing that we've either got to do it now or never, just die, as it were, unfulfilled. Just keep at the back of our minds, well, the possibility of rebirth, but not like some Eastern Buddhist attach so much importance to the idea of rebirth and of future possibilities of treading the path to enlightenment that we forget or neglect to do so in this life itself. So these are just some of the thoughts which have been stirring in my mind just relatively recently. And I think perhaps we in the FWBO, the WBO especially, we have to ask ourselves, well, do we accept the idea of rebirth or not? I think we need to be quite clear about that, or at least try to be clear about it, because it isn't a very easy thing to be clear about. But I think we do owe it to ourselves and to the Dharma even, to ask ourselves what we really think, what we really believe, because it does have, it will have its effect upon our actual practice of the Dharma. So perhaps I should leave you just with that little exhortation, perhaps, that we should give more attention to this particular issue, perhaps discuss it more. I remember in the very early days of Buddhism in this country, when I was around the Buddhist Society, you know, in the 1940s and during the war, people seemed to have no difficulty in accepting the idea of rebirth. It's later on that some Western Buddhists experience difficulty. Many early Buddhists, early Western Buddhists, really welcomed the idea of rebirth. The problem in those days was with God. Whether belief in God was compatible with Buddhism or not, that was the great issue that was discussed. We seem to have left that behind us, but perhaps we do still have to deal with this question of rebirth, or some of us have to deal and make up our minds about it, if we possibly can, one way or the other. But at least think about it, talk about it, discuss it, and be clear in our own minds where we stand.